Craftsman Days are here at Lowe's with big savings on the tools you need. Save $100 on the Craftsman V20 6-Tool Power Tool Combo Kit, now at $199. No matter what the project is, Craftsman's high-quality, high-performance products empower you to build on. Stop by your nearest Lowe's store and check out the full line of Craftsman tools today. Valid through 6/18 while supplies last. Selection varies by location.
Hey, everybody, it's Devin.
And Kate.
Welcome to Med Crimes.
The nostalgia is hitting me right in the feels.
You should see her right now.
I'm getting a little misty.
So over the years, we've gone with, like, you know, our tablets, our nice, like, typed up notes, whatever. And
episode one.
She's got some old school handwritten podcast stuff right here.
This is so cool.
We're bringing it back.
We told you guys, we warned you guys that it was coming, but we are going to redo our very first pilot episode because the case deserves the attention and the detail and the refinement that we can give it now.
Refinement.
And we're going to talk about Charles Cullen. We're going to redo that.
Charles Cullen 2.0.
Yeah, Charles Cullen, a reimagining, if you will.
Ooh.
Ooh.
Do we want to reimagine him?
We don't really want to. We're going to talk about it a lot, but yeah, it's like wild. Yeah.
There. Before we do that, we have a Patreon who's joined the family.
We sure do. His name is John Blanks.
Welcome to the family, John Blanks.
John Blanks, I found you a pretty sweet critter.
I mean, this thing is, as your post it says, this is metal as fuck.
Yeah, I did it and I underlined it. So you're a cockatrice. And a cockatrice is like this two-legged dragon serpent-like beast creature that can kill people with just a look.
This is metal as fuck.
Metal AF. I was saving that for the right
so
person.
So Medusa with a look turns people to stone.
Yeah,
you can kill people.
This is just
people.
Like very murdery. And I just feel like it's super cool and badass. And I love that for you.
Welcome to the family, John
Welcome
Blanks.
Welcome to the family. Peace. And I feel like we should just dive right into this sexy, juicy piece of cake. Right here.
I want cake.
We're just gonna cut into this bad boy right here.
Here we go. Okay. So we first did this one. So this was our very first episode. So we probably recorded this
a million years
ago. Let's see. Episode one, we talked about feeding the Santas.
Yep.
And twinkling lights and how we were eating candy like a rat.
There were apple cider donuts,
yep.
I think.
So
involved.
This was November.
This was
of
just after Halloween 2021. Yeah.
Wow.
And it's now, we're coming up on 3 years.
This is insane.
I mean, it feels like a million years ago. It really feels like a million years ago. But also, I went back and listened to this episode not that long ago, and that was part of what was made me like, I really got to do this again
because we're so much better.
Because we're so much better now. And this case was just such a monster, and it really just deserves just that. It just deserves that.
Tweak.
It just deserves a little bit of an update.
I love that.
So we're going to get through this together, folks.
Charles Cullen.
Are you along for the ride?
God, didn't I say that like four times? I was also doing that weird Twilight thing.
Yeah.
Doo, 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 doo.
I know. Like, I heard that.
Thank God that's gone.
Anyways.
I've been along for the ride for 3 years.
Welcome back to episode one. With Charles Cullen. We're going to try to get this
2.0.
We're going to do it in 2 to 3 parts. We're just going to see how things flow. We're just going to go with the flow.
Mm-hmm.
I like a little go with the flow, you know? So Charles Cullen. Now, he was also known as the Angel of Death Killer. Although I've seen that moniker with like a bunch of the
We just had it with Kristen Gilbert.
Angel of Death,
our episode last, yeah.
And he had confessed to murdering over 40 patients during his 16-year nursing career. There were a lot of interviews, though, like after his arrest and during his incarceration, in which he might be responsible for like up to 400 deaths.
Yeah,
because there were so many incidents, there were so many attempts, there were so many, like, if when we get into the accounts from patients and from coworkers, it's just like the amount of things that he did to people. It's like wild. And we go through how this was allowed to go on as long as it did. Because this amazed me the first time around, how like how this guy did this for 16 years.
I remember being so baffled because I'm just like, you know, how like you said, how could it have gone on for so long? How, you know, different things with background checks. And I was so naive back in episode one.
I know. Now we're like, oh, we know. We're we know like, what oh, they do.
You went on with this for your 30 year career. Yeah. Yep. That sounds normal.
Throw him on the pile with the Dr. others that Shipman. Did the same.
You know, like.
Exactly. Throw him on the pile with the other shitheads that yes. did the same thing. Now, his confirmed victims, the ones that we know for a fact died because of Charles Cullen, mm-hmm. were 29.
Wow.
29.
But he confessed to 40.
He confessed yeah. to 40. We think the number might even be somewhere around 400. But confirmed victims is 29.
No,
I really
I could
can't.
Not imagine.
I really can't. So. Charles Edmund Cullen was born February 22nd, 1960 in West Orange, New Jersey. His parents were Edmund Cullen and Florence Ward Cullen. He was the last of eight children, so he was in a massive family. And he was just
God
like
bless his mother.
The, oh my goodness. And they were a devout Irish Catholic family, which I think like the many, many, many children, all of the children is yes. like a very common theme.
No birth control for
no,
you.
No, none of that. No, we don't do any of that. His father, Edmund, was 57 years old when Charlie was born. So he was an older dad, and his father was a bus driver. And unfortunately, on September 17th, 1960, he actually died suddenly when Charlie was only 7 months old. So Charlie actually never oh. really knew his dad. And he was like totally dependent on his mom, essentially, from babyhood, from like infancy. So this left his
that
mom.
Poor mom have eight children.
Oh, yeah. Left her to raise eight kids all by herself. And she had emigrated to the United States from England after the Second World War. And if you ask Cullen, sadly, he describes his childhood as, quote, miserable. But evidence. So there's evidence, like by all accounts, of like a lot of mental illness type symptoms kind of beginning at a very young age, and we'll go through everything, but and you know who knows, you know, what has been confirmed and what's been, you know, just hearsay because all of this stuff that came out, but
mm-hmm.
he describes his childhood as being pretty miserable, and there was, you know, a lot of issues that kind of were spotted at a very young age. He did recount being very heavily bullied through school by not only people at school, but by his siblings. And specifically, he had a few older sisters and their boyfriends would often bully him also. Like any people, any like boys or men that they brought home ended up like really picking on him for some
that's
reason.
Sad.
Because he was the youngest probably,
course,
you know.
Of
and,
course.
But you know, that's tough. Just you know, it's very isolating.
He doesn't have a father. You know, he needs a father figure.
He doesn't.
And, except for all these men are
exactly,
beating him down.
Exactly. So he's like right away, you know, not an awesome association with like male, like older male figures in his life. He never did great in school. Apparently he engaged like really poorly. He just like never really wanted to give that effort, you know. Like really, really smart kid, but just mm-hmm. like never wanted to apply himself.
Mm-hmm.
His mom was his only source of support and like the only positive thing in his life he would remember. But she never remarried. So she was just, you know, spread very thin between the eight children that she was raising. And he had a great relationship with his mom. He even said, you know, my relationship with my mom was wonderful. And again, she was like the only really good positive thing in his life.
Mm-hmm.
Trigger warning coming up, childhood suicide attempts we're going to be talking about.
Mm.
At age nine.
Man, it's amazing how much I have forgotten.
I know. When I was reading through this a second time, and so I was just like, this is really wild and really sad. Mm-hmm. Like from beginning to end, this is a wild ride. It's wild. So age nine is when he made the first of several suicide attempts. And he did this by drinking chemicals from a chemistry set that was purchased for him.
Wow.
That
makes me so sad for him.
I mean, at age nine, I have an eight-year-old who's almost nine.
I know.
And I
was just thinking that because when we brought it up before, she wasn't nearly close to that.
I mean, but to be at a point in your life when you're age nine, that you feel like you're so hopeless that and everything is so bad that you know, take that step. It just, it, as a kid who's nine, I
want to know. I mean, I know that there's a lot of information out there that children have access to that they shouldn't have access to. But
totally.
At age nine, how do you even have the forethought to like know that if I do this, it could cause this? It could cause my death.
I don't know.
You know, like it's frightening.
Maybe it's because I just like try to protect my kids from, you know, a lot of the negativity that's out there. It's really hard because it's just everywhere and it's so mm-hmm. accessible these days and it's just in your face wherever mm-hmm. you go. But I just can't even imagine my kid, and I hope to whatever's out there that this is true and that she never has that thought cross her mind. But I like that break. It just breaks my heart for mm-hmm. that mom, you know, mm-hmm. who's spread so thin, and like her youngest baby boy, mm-hmm. you know, is having these horribly intrusive thoughts. It's just so sad. He recalled that he considered himself a late life mistake to his parents.
Oh,
I think being that his father was really older, his siblings were all, you know,
and I bet you that probably came from his siblings too.
Oh, 100%.
You know, if he was a burden and, you
if
know,
he,
just
if he was getting that idea, somebody gave him that idea. Like he mm-hmm. didn't just like come up with that on his mm-hmm. own. Like he got at least the inkling from somewhere. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. So that's sad. So
especially I wonder if there was a big age gap between him and the first seven.
Yeah.
You know,
he
like,
was he
number
was,
seven was a 10 years older than him. I don't know.
I don't think it was 10, but I think it was like 7 or 8 right, years. Like right. enough of a gap when you have that mm-hmm. many kids that, mm-hmm. you know, it made him kind of feel that way. And he recalls that their childhood home in West Orange, New Jersey was a quote, dark, unhappy place. Mm. Which like that's heartbreaking because your home should be like, you know,
A safe space.
You know, that's where you get, you know, your snuggles and your food and your bed. And just it just breaks my heart when like kids don't have a safe place to go.
For sure.
You know, that's just so sad. Mm. The older siblings drifted in and out of the house and would like often, you know, even though that they were like sort of on in years as Charlie got older, they would be sort of like in and out of the house, like ended up, you know, dating people, meeting people, staying with them, then coming back and bringing all these like new people into the house. And there would be issues with drug addiction among his older siblings, and they would like be bringing that into the house.
He was exposed to a lot.
And there was, you know, one of his siblings, I think, had a younger, like, teen pregnancy that he kind of was around for all of that. And again, strange men and women in and out of his life all the time. And he reported that by these, like, strangers that would come in and by, like, people that were on some drug dealings and stuff, he would be physically abused by them, too. So everybody was, like, ganging up on poor Charlie here. This is one of those stories where like early on you're like really feeling for this kid, and then like later in life you're like, oh.
So no. Did we, and by we I mean society at that point in time, turn him into the monster he became?
I mean it's hard to say for sure because
nature,
like,
versus nurture. What
you just never know.
Is it
because
in you already when you're born?
A lot of people are raised in, quote, dark, unhappy places with shitty childhoods, and they do not
they
grow
do
up
not
and murder,
murder 400 people.
People. Nope. No, they do not. So I kind of feel like it's, you know, whether or not there were mental health issues, I think it was evident that he knew exactly what he was doing when he did it. And mm-hmm. he made that conscious decision to do it. And he's a shitbag for doing it.
Yeah.
But his childhood did suck. His only solace was mom. And he desperately like sought her positive reinforcement, her affection, and her attention. But again, there was just like never enough to go around. You right. know what I mean? Just like there was just so many kids and so many issues going on. And like even with the kids that were out of the house, there was always some fire that mom's putting out because these kids are not making great decisions.
Just with my two, I feel like I'm yes. always putting out fires.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Same. And they're like little kids.
Don't multiply it by four.
No, God, no. Nope. I would die. Yeah. My 6 and 8 year old, I'm like, everything is a hot mess. Yes, I'm sorry.
My 5 year old told me that he was going to kiss me and hug me even when he was big like me.
I mean.
So I hope that's true.
That is pretty adorable.
I get to go home and play the tooth fairy.
pretty adorable. We yes, you do.
We lost
by
our
the way.
First tooth. I've played Easter Bunny. Yes, I've played do. Santa Claus. I oh have yet to play gosh. The Tooth Fairy.
That is adorable.
How do parents get that out from under the pillow without waking them up?
Oh, so for me,
what's the goal? What's the tangent?
I mean, so for me, it's and it's gotten harder because my daughter used to be such a sound sleeper that I could like literally pick her up and like toss her across the room and she would not even wake up. But now in her older age, she's a lighter sleeper somehow. So you really do have to. It's a very ninja, very much like a.
I mean, I was just telling you earlier that that baby tooth is sprawled out into a gallon sized sandwich bag. Oh, yeah. Because that's all I had when we were camping. Yeah. And it's in a gallon Ziploc bag, mm-hmm. folded ever so neatly under mm-hmm. the pillow currently. And I don't know how I'm going to get that thing out, but we will find out.
You are going to find out, and it's going to be ninjalicious. I mm-hmm. can't wait to hear how you do it. I really can't. Mm-hmm. So sadly, during his senior year of high school in 1977,
breaks my heart.
This does, yeah. His mom, who again is basically the center of the universe to him, was killed suddenly in a car wreck. And one of his sisters was driving the vehicle. So this was a point in his life that he considers that he was like, I considered myself at that moment, I was completely alone in this world. I was alone. This was the devastating turning point in his mm-hmm. life.
Mm-hmm.
Heartbreaking.
It's traumatic.
This is his source of support, literally like his only positive light in his life. And he recalls being furious with the hospital that had her body because he wanted to see her, I guess, at the hospital she was brought to. He went there to try and like view her body, but it had already, by the time he got there, it had already been taken away and he was not able to view her body for whatever reason. And he remembers that he was absolutely furious with that hospital and he was completely inconsolable. Like security mm-hmm. had to remove him. It was like a big deal.
They were obviously probably, I mean, whether it was purposeful or not, it was probably a good thing.
Well, probably. I mean, if she, you know, was in bad enough shape that she mm-hmm. died in the car wreck, you know, mm-hmm. unfortunately. This was a moment that did trigger another suicide attempt for him. At this point, he also dropped out of high school. This was his senior year. And he drops out because he just cannot function.
I mean,
he his life like stops right here.
He had so much devastating stuff in his life already up to this point.
Mm-hmm.
So then really he's hitting a depression stage of 100%. What's left. What's yes. the point? You know,
exactly. So being left with like not a, you know, ton of prospects for the future, he decides to enlist in the Navy. So his Navy life was not really a whole lot kinder to him. He was often bullied and hazed by his colleagues. He states he never really fit in well. Despite this, he actually did well, though, like in his training and such. So he completed a missile training and he served aboard the USS Woodrow Wilson submarine. And he rose to Petty Officer Third Class.
It's the fourth enlisted rank in the U.S. Navy. And the U.S. Coast Guard, and the lowest rank of non-commissioned officer.
Okay.
So he's gone up. He's at the fourth yeah. level. So got there's three it. Levels below him.
Okay.
And it's the lowest ranking officer level.
Got it. So he was an officer.
So petty officer. Right. Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay. Good for him.
Yep.
So, I mean, he had risen like a pretty reasonable, mm-hmm. you know, amount. And he was doing fairly well. He was living on a submarine and living underwater. And this is a lot for anybody. But he was having a hard time coping with that. And he continued to have bullying issues and he had such a trauma, I think, deep seated from that, that this was like very triggering for him. He started drinking heavily, which apparently back then in the Navy was very common. There was, you know, alcohol was never really in short supply anywhere mm-hmm. that you looked. If you wanted it, you could get it pretty easily. And because of that, he had many disciplinary hearings. He got caught drinking and was, you know, drunk while he was performing his duties a couple of times and got disciplined a couple of times.
So I'm surprised he was able to bring himself up. You know what I mean?
Oh, like, I know. I think he rose like before things kind of like deteriorated again, maybe. He had one time where he like had refused to urinate before another sailor. They were trying to get him to give like a witnessed urine sample and he refused to do it. He reported that he never did drugs, but he felt humiliated at the thought that somebody thought that he was maybe on drugs and that they were going to test him for drugs. And that was like very humiliating for him. He was very much a person who was very aware of how they presented on the outside. And that translates when we get into his working environment and like what he does in the future. So he was very embarrassed by not looking perfect on the outside. I think that was very humiliating.
It's interesting though, then just urinate for them. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, like, it's like just pee and just.
If you're embarrassed about how the presentation appears, but then prove it.
Exactly. If you're really not, then like.
What if I told you that right now, millions of people are living with a debilitating condition that's so misunderstood, many of them don't even know that they have it? That condition is obsessive compulsive disorder, or OCD. I'm Dr. Patrick McGrath, the Chief Clinical Officer of NOCD. And in the 25 years I've been treating OCD, I've met so many people who were suffering from the condition in silence, unaware of just what it was. OCD can create overwhelming anxiety and fear around what you value most, make you question your identity, beliefs, and morals, and drive you to perform mentally and physically draining compulsions or rituals. Over my career, I've seen just how devastating OCD can be when it's left untreated. But help is available. That's where NOCD comes in. NOCD is the world's largest virtual therapy provider for obsessive compulsive disorder. Our licensed therapists are trained in exposure and response prevention therapy, a specialized treatment proven to be incredibly effective for OCD. So visit NOCD.com to schedule a free 15-minute call with our team. That's NOCD.com.
What's your problem? I do know that while he was in the Navy, he did assist with exams, like medical exams, and he assisted in the infirmary a lot, and he administered vaccinations. And it's thought that maybe this is where his interest in medicine was kind of born. Mm-hmm. Because he was getting a lot of experience in like doing the medical stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And the boiling point kind of comes when his shipmates report finding Cullen at the launch panel for nuclear missiles.
That sounds terrifying.
Alone, without even going into how they found him. That's scary. So he was found at the launch panel for the nuclear missiles wearing a surgical gown, masks and gloves from the medical supply closet. Also, Cullen, if you ask him about this, he goes, that's not true. But like all of the documentation, like from the official like report from this, like, no, that did happen. And he actually, it's evident that he like tried to conceal all of this and tried to sort of have this buried for like years. Like he's, I think, very embarrassed that this happened.
As you should be.
Exactly. And I guess they had tried to get him to give a drug test many times before this, but they kept failing to get like a clean urine sample from him. So I suspect that he was probably abusing drugs at this point, because like why else is he adulterating and trying to hide that? So when he was found in that state by the nuclear launch pad, dressed as Dr. Surgery the Clown, I don't really know what he was going for. He was actually transferred from the submarine. So he was transferred to a supply boat, and then subsequently he was discharged from the Navy. And the reason he was discharged was undisclosed officially. So they don't actually list a reason. Mm-hmm. This was in March of 1984 that he was discharged sort of neutrally from the
Navy.
So
it wasn't dishonorably or honorably.
No, it was undisclosed. It was undisclosed. Mm. Yes. He estimates, if you ask him, 12 to 20 total suicide attempts throughout his life.
My goodness.
12 to 20. Like, and he says, no, these were like not cries for help. These were me trying to end my life. multiple times.
I don't remember if I said this in the first one, but given how much we know, like, happens to him later on and mm-hmm. why he ended up being our first med crimes case and yes. so notorious.
Yes.
Why could he figure out how to kill that many people but not himself?
I know. That's the thing.
That is completely insensitive of me to say.
But
however, it's true, correct? Because what he does later on when we get there
is very effective a lot of the time.
Awful yes. and effective because he was why could he well not figure out how to do it himself if it was not a cry for attention?
And he like I said, he claims 100% these were all legitimate attempts to end my life. These were not cries for help, but it's impossible to.
He eventually figured out a way to kill other human beings.
Yeah, of course.
So if you really wanted to do yes. it to yourself.
Yep. And he would say, like, his method was always ingestion. It was always taking something. It was never anything mechanical or anything outwardly violent. It was always, I'm going to try to take something. And it would be like anything he could get his hands on. So like at age 9, it was chemicals from a chemistry mm-hmm. set. At age 17, following his mom's death, he reported it was pills. I'm not sure what it was, but he had always stated it was a bunch of pills. He took a bunch of pills. The time that he had an attempt while he was in the Navy in the submarine, he had taken a whole bunch of aspirin, and he was actually treated for aspirin, like overdose, methyl salicylate poisoning. And he also would often use aspirin and mix it with oil of wintergreen, which is like literally the oil that is in like mouthwash. And it's intoxicating, I guess, too. And it has like a high alcohol content. And he would mix those very regularly. And he said, even when I wasn't, you know, in a bad place mentally and when I was just recreationally like drinking, I would often like take, you know, a whole bunch of aspirin or a whole bunch of Tylenol with the alcohol. So
Jesus.
I mean, obviously, well, this evolves then later on into like drug, like illicit drug use, and mm-hmm. the heavy drinking is sort of like a continuing theme too throughout his life. And so he often reported that he fantasized about suicide and ending his life. Like he would, when he wasn't attempting suicide, he was like thinking about ways to end his life. At least this is what he says. And
do you think he's trying to come off to get some compassion?
Maybe.
Because I'm still so puzzled by it.
I mean, he is a very, I agree, but he is a very troubled man.
Very troubled. I do not disagree about that.
And it sounds like he did have a very traumatic childhood.
Yes.
And there is no record of him ever receiving any mental health support or treatment whatsoever, as was very common in this time period for people that were mm-hmm. suffering from mental health ailments. So, mm-hmm. I mean, if it's true what he's saying, we're at least a dozen suicide attempts by, how old is he? 25, right? I mean, that's like wild. So following his suicide attempts in the Navy, he was actually committed while he was in the Navy to psychiatric ward, like while he was in the Navy before he was actually discharged.
Well, as he should be.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yes. Absolutely. And following that discharge in 1984, he went and enrolled in Mountainside Hospital School of Nursing, which was in Montclair, New Jersey. And in school, he did very well, and he actually thrived in the school environment. And he recalled that he actually had really positive associations, really positive memories from being in this phase of his life when he was in nursing school.
What do you think changed?
I don't know if maybe it was like a come to Jesus moment when his life was falling apart. He was using substances. He was just discharged from the Navy, probably for psychiatric reasons. And, mm-hmm. and you know, we don't know. I'm speculating there.
Right.
And, you know, maybe this was like a moment where he was like, you know what, I'm going to take control of my life and like try to really spin things more positively and create a good situation for myself for once. And make this decision and try to set myself up for the future.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a genuine interest in anatomy and physiology and pharmacology, the chemical mm-hmm. stuff. Like we mm-hmm. know, you know, we know from, you know, his fascination with substances right. that he likes the chemistry stuff. But he also was like, maybe I can actually apply this to something that's more useful and functional and not just, you know, me dicking around, taking whatever I want, and once in a while getting very depressed and trying to kill myself. So
that didn't last long.
No, it did not. So again, he did very well. He excelled because, again, he was fascinated. He liked the medical stuff. It just really was seeming to click a little bit. He was the only male student in his class. This is in 1984, right? So male nurses, that's not entirely surprising. I mean, I know a lot of like older male nurses who went to school around that time, but male nurses are a lot more common now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're pretty much 50-50 where I've been a lot. Like
20 years later, though, when you and I were in nursing school.
Again, a lot more ladies.
We had only a handful. Exactly. Less than a handful.
Yes,
so,
yeah, very true. Very true. He was actually elected president of his nursing class.
Good for him.
I mean, he was like pretty much killing it. He was doing great.
And then he was killing others.
And then he was killing not it, but others.
Not it.
So while he was in school, he did work at a Dunkin' Donuts and a Roy Rogers to pay his way through school.
Mm-hmm.
And it was at Roy Rogers where he met Adrienne Baum, who was a manager at the Roy Rogers branch that he worked at. She was also working through school and she was earning a business degree. She was just like, I'm gonna grow up and be like a boss bitch, you know. And Charlie admired her.
I'm gonna be a boss bitch.
I'm gonna be a boss bitch. And Charlie admired her ambition and he thought she was like super sophisticated. And he's from this, you know, smaller town in New Jersey, West Orange. And he remembered like, boy, looking at her and seeing that she's like, you know, a manager at a Roy Rogers and she's working her way through business school. Like this was like a sophisticated, like educated mm-hmm. woman. Mm-hmm. And I'm just like not used to that.
Right.
So he was very.
I bet you she was probably. And again, this is me speculating. But let's think about it. He's probably the only male in the nursing program.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sure there was a hell of a lot more men.
Yes.
Than women in the business side.
Exactly. Right? Oh, so exactly. Like, exactly. Yeah. So
again, speculating, but
he was pretty infatuated and he very quickly, you know, was just very beguiled by this mm-hmm. woman. At the time that they met, Adrienne did have a boyfriend, but during her time there, they had split while Cullen was working there. So the two got closer after the split. And the relationship kind of like took off and started moving really quickly. Adrienne recalls that Charlie was the shy, wide-eyed, like sort of younger kid, but he was like really good looking and kind of cute. And he was like sweet and funny. And once he opened up, she saw that he was really confident. Like once he actually started really like speaking up, you know, about himself, he was just this like really confident young man. And he was really like had a lot of depth to him. And she liked that he was really serious about a nursing career. She's like, you know, I love that for you. I think that's a wonderful fit. It's a great career path, you know, wonderful job opportunities. So she thought it was really smart of him to go for that. And he like love bombed the shit out of her. So love he was bombed. Like, I remember this from the first go around too, showered her with gifts. And he was like the model boyfriend. So he was like always there. He was always calling. He was like showering her in compliments. Her family loved him because he was just the most attentive, the sweetest, like the most protective. So the family like immediately were like over the moon. Like mm-hmm. he was just like this great guy. And psychiatrists later theorized that actually this is sort of part of Charlie's pattern of codependence. And especially with females in his life, stemming from, you know, the codependence with his mom of, you know, he would just like love bomb someone and then just, you know, devote his entire life to that person.
Mm-hmm.
And then when it doesn't like sort of live up to, you know, this ethereal image of what he and his mom had, everything sort of like deteriorates. And we kind of get into that as well.
Or when the girls are really starting to see the red flags exactly. with the love bombing too.
There's so many red flags.
Like you need to
yes.
breaks.
Exactly. So 6 months after they officially got together and became a couple, they were engaged. So things are moving pretty quickly. They married the week after Charlie graduated school. So in 1986, they got married and everything was just like a fairy tale. You know, they move in together. They get this little house. Just after they honeymooned in Niagara Falls, he began his first job, and his first job was at St. Barnabas Medical Center in the burn unit. And coincidentally, this was the same hospital his mother died at, and the same hospital that called to notify him that his mom has been in an accident. You need to get here right now. And said, I'm sorry, she passed and we've already removed the body and you can't see her. In the same hospital he was absolutely infuriated with during that whole situation.
Mm-hmm.
This was actually the only certified burn unit in the state of New Jersey. And so the burn unit, any burn unit staff out there, because this has always fascinated me. It's very much its own specialty. It's its very own physiology treating burns.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fascinating and it's scary as hell. And these people, I mean,
I find
you think
it terrifying, honestly.
So scary. Yeah. And these people can become so unstable so quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And they're very tenuous, especially these people with burns over, you know, large amounts of their body. It just affects the body and, you know, the entire body ecosystem in such a profound way. It's like, it's crazy. It's crazy.
It's our largest organ that essentially has just been incinerated.
Yes, it's wild. So the burn unit there treated a slew of burn injuries from car accident victims, house fires, industrial spills, chemical burns, often small children. I mean, there were kids are frequent burn victims from, you know, kids get into everything. And severity ranged anywhere from like minor injuries to extreme life-threatening injuries, which would render people just completely unrecognizable, like catastrophic injuries. So, I mean, it was either, you know, there was such a huge spectrum for what he was treating here. One of Charlie's jobs was wound care, of course.
Of course.
And removing necrotic burnt skin from wound beds is part of the process,
which I hear is one of the most excruciating, painful things that someone can ever endure.
I have heard the same. Although some burn patients, I do believe if you have third degree or full thickness burns, the nerves are ablated.
Right,
and so there's very minimal pain. Yep. So but in some situations, yes, yeah. I think it is incredibly excruciating. And even for like seasoned nurses, critical care nurses and like wound care nurses, people that have seen all kinds of wounds, this is a gruesome, grueling task that you need to do.
Mm-hmm.
The smell, the pain, it's all very tiresome work. And then comes, you know, it's not just about the skin. People think of, oh, it's a burn unit, got to treat the skin. And like I said, it affects the entire body. And replacing the fluid and electrolyte losses and placing lines for access and monitoring, and it's this massive undertaking, taking care of an unstable.
My God, how do you, like, I mean, I'm thinking of, like, how do you place lines for the hydration?
Hope and pray that there's something
that is
intact. That
viable part of the body?
Yes, and a lot of them probably end up with arterial, art lines and, like, deep vein accesses because everything superficially has just been ablated completely.
Wow.
Just like so, oh, so
and that's
scary.
Just for simple hydration.
That's literally for like replacing all of the fluid losses. And what bothered Charlie was the kids. And that, I mean, for me too, because I am not a pediatric nurse. Mm-hmm. I never really have. I worked in labor and delivery and I did babies I could do, birthing babies, healthy babies, sick kids.
I have a hard time with. When we did the pediatric rotation, that's the only experience I have with taking care of kids, and that was what, 6 weeks next to nothing.
Yes,
and even then I went more towards the teenagers.
Yes, 100%.
I didn't want
Same.
The young kids.
Yep, I had a hard time. So Charlie recalled that the kids really bothered him, and he always said that suffering in general bothered him. He always maintained that suffering in general bothered him, and I don't know if he's saying that because he tries in the end to kind of blame everything on, everybody was suffering and I was just trying to alleviate their suffering. And these are all mercy killings and mercy.
Are we sure?
Which, like, I think maybe you just,
no,
like killing people. I don't know. So he always said that really bothered him in general. And at the time, like the adults that were in the burn unit would receive morphine, but children back in this day couldn't get anything other than Tylenol number 3, which is acetaminophen with a little bit of codeine in it. So not a whole lot of strong pain medication.
Has that changed now?
Oh yeah.
Thank God.
Yeah. No,
thank God.
Things are different now, yeah. So that really bothered Charlie, I guess. And these patients would undergo these like extensive surgeries to prevent contractures and to try to keep their joints mobile as they healed. There would be multiple debridements. There'd be skin grafting. I mean, this is a weeks and weeks and weeks long hospitalization on average for people that come in with massive burns all over their body if they survive. And then, you know, once they're closed up and somewhat stable, they got to put these like suits on, like these swelling suits that like cover their whole bodies, and they minimize scarring because you can get these big keloid growths from burn scarring. And it helps to keep their joints mobile and the swelling down. And it's just like this whole big thing, this whole big to do. Charlie's shift was nights, and he always liked working nights. That was like actually the bulk of what he did was work nights. And early on, like, he hit the floor running. And I remember talking about this when we did this before too, is that like, it was amazing how much his coworkers loved and respected him just right out the gate. You know, he was going. He had all the energy in the world. He was bright as shit, and he learned really fast. And again, this is probably a really good specialty for him, because he's loving the chemistry stuff and the math stuff. And I mean, there's formulas you got to calculate for burn victims, like, to, you know, ascertain what their risk is of, you know, mortality. And, you know, there's so much involved in this. And so he like really excelled at that. So October 1987, Adrienne and Charlie bought a house. Adrienne got a job as a computer programmer, and she was not like thrilled with that because it wasn't what she really wanted to do. She really wanted to she wanted to be a boss bitch, right? Mm-hmm. She was really good with computers. She was really skilled. And computers were just like becoming a lot more prevalent, more popular. And this was like great job this security was probably for a her.
Big honker.
Huge.
Probably it took was up the whole
the
desk.
Size of the basement down here. But again, these are like computers are developing. Like, there's a lot of a lot of job security in that field. So she wasn't thrilled, but it was better than fast food. So she's like, I'll do anything as long as it gets me closer to what I want to do. Charlie was very upfront about his history of mental health issues with Adrienne. So she was very well aware before they got married that he had issues with depression, that he had issues with alcoholism, which at this point is in remission. So he's not currently drinking during this time. And she found this, you know, endearing that he would, you know, bring this all to her and be very upfront about it. And she, you know, at the time felt like she knew his past and that they were past that. And he was at a better point in his life, and he had gotten his life together. So she honestly was under the impression that he was in control of all of those demons that were in the past. Now, February of 1988 rolls around, and Adrienne finds out she's pregnant. And things kind of shifted here at this point because, I mean, as they do, when somebody gets pregnant, the entire family life dynamic changes.
It's kind of a big deal.
Kind of a big deal. So Charlie was overjoyed. I mean, overjoyed at the idea of being a dad and at the idea of having kids. But he was like maybe a little possessive and maybe a little obsessive about things.
In what way?
I mean, Adrienne had recalled around this time that she started feeling a little neglected. Like, he wasn't like addressing her at all. He was just like talking about the baby, planning for the baby. Every conversation took a turn towards the baby. They couldn't enjoy time alone as husband and wife without everything revolving around the baby. And Adrienne was like, I mean, I'm overjoyed too. I'm also psyched for this baby, but can you and I just like sit quietly and have a coffee together and like talk about our day?
Right.
Yeah, exactly. Like, she's starting to feel like she's now falling by the wayside, and she's literally a uterus with a baby in it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, as a person, I'm not seeing that you're enjoying my company as a person.
Mm-hmm.
So that fall in 1988, Adrienne gave birth to their daughter, Shauna. And Charlie, once the baby came, had a tough time sort of allocating and dividing his affections, as if he had to like pick one to be his.
Well, if you think focus. About it, he's never really had to have a multifocus.
Well, exactly.
Because
he doesn't know how to do this.
He only ever had his mom.
Exactly.
You know, he didn't have siblings that cared for and whatnot, you know, for him to give that love and affection to.
Absolutely.
Just mom. He didn't have two parent, you know.
Oh, yeah. Exactly.
And then he only had Adrienne.
Exactly. So. Yep. So he had a really, it was really hard for him to sort of reconcile, you know, I can love my wife in a husband and wife way and as a mother of my child way, and I can love my child in this completely different and completely also equally beautiful way.
Mm-hmm.
And it's okay for me to love two things.
Right.
And I don't have to worship this one unit.
Right.
I can worship my entire family. Correct. And that's okay. But he had a really hard time sort of figuring that out.
Mm.
And by all accounts, when the baby came, like Shauna, he was smitten, like he was obsessed. He loved spending all the time, always wanted to hold her, always wanted to take care of her. But very quickly that faded, like the magic kind of wore off, you know, once the, you know, honeymoon phase, as we
sleep set
as
in.
We all know it. And he's a night shifter, right? So he's awake at night, and he's going to be awake during the day, sometimes taking care of the baby, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So that got old quickly. And then, of course, other baby stuff, like the fussing and like the not being able to, you know, having less freedom and having less autonomy.
Is this
and
not as joyous as what I thought?
Is this not all puppies and rainbows? Fuck, I did not get that memo. Mm. Can we return this thing?
Nope.
No, you can't return them. The family, Charlie and his family, of note, had a dog, a Yorkie named Lady. And after the baby came, after Shauna came, they also got a new puppy. So they got a second Yorkie.
That was bold.
Which is a lot.
I mean, come on.
That's a big move. So this new puppy was meant to be like a companion for Lady, their existing Yorkie, which like I get because Sally was so lonely after Molly passed away.
Yes.
And now our new dog, Stella, who you guys all met on the show, is Sally's dog, emotional support animal. Anyway, Yorkies, two Yorkies in this family.
And a newborn.
So one morning, Adrienne leaves for work on Charlie's day off. So Charlie had come home from a night shift, but he's got the day off and then the following night off. When she gets home, the puppy, the little puppy, the new puppy, was gone. And Charlie was alarmingly underwhelmed by the whole situation. The puppy was literally just not in the house. And Adrienne is like, so where's our new puppy? And he did not care. He was like, I don't know. What do you expect that I'm going to just like keep track of this tiny baby animal that I consented to come live in my home?
Here?
The kid's
Does that
here.
Matter?
The kid's breathing.
I
what
kept
more
the kid
do you
alive.
Want from me? So,
I mean, I won't lie. I felt that way some days.
Yeah, honestly, we've all had those days. And then he goes, oh, the puppy. Right. The puppy. Now I remember what you're talking about. Fuck. So it ran away. I took it out for a walk. And while the baby was sleeping, which, wait, you left the baby at home by herself to sleep? And
the
you
baby
took the
was
dog?
In a stroller while the dog was walking.
Although, I don't think he said that. He said, while the baby was sleeping, I went for a walk.
I was being optimistic.
Yeah, I know. So Adrienne immediately is confused because this is odd and it doesn't make any sense. And what do you mean the dog ran out? Did you not have her on a leash? Like, did she slip the leash? I need more information. What the fuck is going on? Immediately she's like, this seems weird. Like, what is actually going on? And at one point she actually suspected that Charlie had given the baby cold medicine to put her to sleep. And
why did she suspect this?
I'm actually not sure. I don't know the exact reason, but she must have found something or seen something that led her to believe, oh my God, are you giving my baby cold medicine so that she'll sleep for you so that you don't have to take care of her when you're home?
Oh shit.
And they had like fights about this. Like she confronted him right away. And he denied it, of course. Why would I ever do that?
I'm a nurse, for God's sakes.
I am a nurse, ma'am. How dare you?
You don't know me.
You don't know me. He gaslit a lot.
Of course.
He made her feel crazy a lot.
Hate
and
those.
Then she notices Charlie starting to drink again. She's seeing alcohol in the house, and he's starting to sort of spiral into this depression. And Adrienne is starting to feel very alone. Even when he's home, he's like not like engaging with her or socializing. He's like very shut down at this point. He's like, the magic of the new wife, the new baby has like straight up worn off. I am like, I'm overwhelmed, and this is my coping. I'm going to just drink myself into a depressed oblivion and just not
deal with it. And you're going to deal with it.
And she would confide like in her family and friends, and all of them would just be like, you know, it sounds like he's going through a rough time. Like, why don't you just like support him? He works really hard. And, you know, this is also like a time where, you know, women wouldn't, you know, necessarily rush to divorce someone who's given them a lot of red flags, because, I mean, you want to try to work it out, mm-hmm. you know, and her family is encouraging her to like stick around, hang out, stay, work it out, like really just, mm-hmm. you know, try work on your marriage. She starts noticing he's spending a lot of time in the basement. And one afternoon, there was a neighbor's dog that often wandered the neighborhood. This dog's name was Queenie the dog. And this dog was found dead in the space between the Cullens' home and their neighbor's home. And it was obvious that the dog had been poisoned. Like, I'm not sure how they found the dog or what state she was in.
Frothing at the mouth or something.
Maybe, like, obviously had ingested something mm-hmm. poisonous, which, like, dogs get into things. Like, who knows? You know, she could mm-hmm. have eaten something. But Adrienne, like, immediately, she was like, I feel like Charlie had something to do with this. I don't really know why, but I feel like Charlie would do that. Like, right now in this moment, how he's acting, I feel like Charlie would do this.
Well, again, with how he's acting and her suspicions of the cold medicine, yes, and whatnot. Yeah.
Exactly. So she often heard strange noises coming from the basement, and she actually suspected that he was hurting their older dog, Lady. Like, he would bring Lady into the basement, and then she would hear like whining and crying. Adrienne would, mm-hmm. and she would like confront Charlie, and Charlie would be like, "No, I'm training her." Like, what dog, like, cries and, you know, squeals and whines during training? Unless you're hurting
not
that
positive
dog.
Reinforcement training.
Not the right kind of training. So, Cullen later reported to investigators that the first murder of many that he actually committed was in June of 1988. And this is when he admits he provided a male patient with a lethal dose of insulin, and this was never confirmed, but this is something he reported. So obviously mm-hmm. on his unit, somebody had a medical event that was probably chalked up to them being unstable, and he was never investigated or suspected of anything, but he claims that
was his first victim,
his first murder.
Does he remember who they were? Yep. Or
So that one, he doesn't even give the name. So we don't even know, even though he admits it. Like, they couldn't even, if he doesn't remember the name, how do we even know? Now, his first confirmed murder was in 1988 as well. This was Judge John Yingo, who was admitted with Stevens-Johnson syndrome, thought to be a reaction to warfarin. So SJS is a serious life-threatening condition, which is super, super rare. And it's characterized by painful blistering of the skin and like this rash that spreads, and essentially your skin just sloughs off like in these huge bits. And these patients are often treated in burn units because they're treated very similarly mm-hmm. and they have a lot of similar medical needs. But Cullen apparently administered a lethal dose of insulin, which killed him. And he is the only named victim at St. Barnabas. But Cullen, again, maintains that he killed a lot of people at St. Barnabas. This is the only one that's confirmed that is named that he killed there. Um, Now, Cullen claims to investigators that he killed a total of 11 people, actually, during his time at St. Barnabas. And these people were very sick, often very unstable. So initially, the deaths, while they were tragic, didn't raise, you know, right. a huge amount of suspicion. And they were just attributed to whatever injuries or ailments they had.
Right.
And then autopsies and toxicology testing is not like routinely performed on everybody. So they wouldn't necessarily get investigated that hard if they were chalked up to something else. And of note, many of St. Barnabas's medical records from this time were lost or destroyed. So that hindered this investigation a ton. And we can't confirm any of what he's claiming here on his own.
And we found that out when? Like, it was years later.
Oh, during
though,
the
right?
investigation. Yeah, years
so
later.
It was like years mm-hmm. later when oh, they're yeah. like, no, that's, mm-hmm. just, so, we just don't have them.
And as we see how these hospitals start to react when he's jumping from place to place, spoiler alert, it becomes apparent that hospitals are just going to make a lot of these records just disappear and go mm-hmm. away forever. And we don't actually know what happened to those.
Mm-hmm.
Weird.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry.
Gosh, I don't know.
Whoops.
I checked the file room.
I checked that big room. You know, with the files. It's not funny, but it's just like kind of preposterous that yes. was like allowed to happen. And now there are laws in place that prevent people from doing that. So we'll talk about that too.
And everything's on a computer.
And everything is on a computer. So everything leaves like a little bit of a trail wherever
mm-hmm.
it is.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll notice that a lot of what Charlie says he's doing here is using insulin, right? So insulin is a medication given to diabetic patients to aid in control of blood sugar. And when given in correct doses to patients prone to hyperglycemia or high blood sugar, it can help to keep blood sugar stable. But if insulin is given to non-diabetic patients or patients with a already normal or low blood sugar, it can result in life-threatening hypoglycemic events. So if those are not treated very quickly, that can be fatal very easily. So he tells us that he used insulin frequently, and what he would do is grab a vial of insulin and fill up a syringe, and he'd go around and just spike bags of normal saline that were hanging at like people's bedside. People would have these IV drips of like normal saline or other fluids going in, and he would just,
and now they just have insulin
in the rubber stopper, just put a whole syringe full of insulin, and now they're getting a bolus of insulin. And these IV fluids were often getting infused really rapidly because these people are getting rehydrated rapidly, mm-hmm. getting rapid infusers because of the burns.
Mm-hmm.
And they're getting hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of units of insulin at once.
I can't even imagine.
So even if somebody is crashing and you're working a code and you find during your little mini code workup that this person is acutely hypoglycemic, these people have received so much insulin that you can give them dextrose and dextrose and dextrose, and they are going to crash.
You can't re-sugarize them.
Like, they are going to crash yes. right through all of that
yes.
and not ever come out of that.
You're
and
not going to be able to like.
You're not going to fix
give them
that.
Enough sugar
exactly
to counter how much that you know they're currently dropping.
Exactly, exactly. So around this time, also of note, narcotic medications that were on the unit were kept under lock and key and carefully documented and accounted for to prevent theft of the drugs. So mm-hmm. they were kept in like a room in a cabinet, and there were counts. So the oncoming nurse would have to count with mm-hmm. the offgoing nurse. And nowadays on units, pharmacies take care of this, and they have these Accudoses or Omnicells or Pyxis and systems that will keep count for you. But there was a lot of counting off and on back then to keep people accountable if drugs mm-hmm. did go missing. So drugs like insulin, though, and other drugs were just kind of stocked, and they were not closely monitored. So it was, you know, they were just like sort of on a shelf. I mean, anybody could go in and grab a vial of insulin and it wouldn't ever raise any suspicion whatsoever. They were so easily accessible. And then Charlie worked at St. Barnabas until 1991. So it was like about a 88, 90, 91. So about a 3-year period
okay.
that he worked there. On February 11th of 1991, which is a great day.
I don't know what you're talking about.
I don't know either. A pharmaceutical nurse named Pam Allen got a hold of an IV bag that appeared to have been tampered with. She's a she's a nurse that works with the pharmaceutical department at St. Barnabas. And she was looking at the bag and she noticed that the rubber stopper on the bottom of the bag had been pierced and was leaking a little bit. And the bag looked unusually full. If you are somebody who works with IV fluids a lot, you know that there's like a tiny bit of squish and a little bit of air in the bag, but this bag was taut.
A little bit of squish.
A little bit of squish, you know. We'll have a little bit of squish in the bag. But this one was like tight and like it was very full. And she's like, this looks
this is weird.
Obviously, this is like a bad bag or somebody tampered with it. But also you can see like this is supposed to be like a newly stocked bag that has not been used. Why is there a hole in the rubber stopper? And why does it look so full? Something else is in here. So she found it. She brings it to her superiors. The IV bag was this was not fluids. This was a bag of heparin. So this was a bag of IV heparin, which is an anticoagulant. These IV heparin is often given in a drip if it's used to treat things like blood clots, heart attacks, strokes, or other thrombotic events. And they actually took it down to the pathology lab and they tested it. And they found that this bag of what was supposed to just be heparin contained massive amounts of insulin. What the fuck?
Mm-hmm.
What the fuck?
Kind of a big deal.
I mean, I feel like this should have, if it didn't trigger like this massive investigation on the unit alone, this one finding.
Mm-hmm.
3 days after this was found, a patient in the CCU, the critical care unit, named Anna Byers, who was admitted for an NSTEMI, was placed on IV heparin. NSTEMIs are commonly treated with IV heparin drips before. An NSTEMI is a heart attack, by the way. A lot of heart attack patients are put on an IV heparin drip to loosen up any little tiny clots that could be causing an obstruction in the coronary artery before they can go in and do their heart cath and open up whatever vessel is tight in there. Once her IV heparin drip started, 30 minutes later, she was cold, clammy, confused, nauseous, shaky. All of these are classic
all the signs
of hypoglycemia. Staff immediately checked her blood sugar and it was undetectably low. So the machine couldn't even get a reading because her blood sugar was so low.
Did they not like check their stock after they found this? You know, 3 days go by. So yeah. Either they checked it and needed it again.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
They just didn't check it.
Why didn't some sort of like surveillance or massive investigation happen immediately when they found that one weird looking IV bag of heparin? Because why? In God's name, unless somebody was trying to do some fuck shit, would there be insulin inside a bag of heparin?
Mm-hmm.
Unless somebody was trying to do some real bad shit.
Do some fuck shit.
Do some fuck shit, as they say. So, staff immediately are acting on Anna Byers' hypoglycemia, giving her IV dextrose to bring up her critically low blood sugar, but she was so loaded with insulin that, again, she is crashing and crashing and crashing right through. And she was kept on a dextrose drip, finally. They were giving her just bags of IV dextrose. And they were able to stabilize her and keep her alive through the next day. The following day, once she stabilized, they stopped her heparin. She went to the cath lab because, again, you know, you stop the heparin. You go to the cath lab for revascularization, where they go in through the groin and they go up and they can put stents into your heart vessels and open things back up if you've had heart attacks. Her blood sugar never dipped after that. Through the cath, she was stable. Now, her cardiac cath unfortunately showed multi-vessel disease. And when that happens, they can't safely just put a stent in one spot. It means all of her vessels are like really pretty tight. And what she really needs is like open heart surgery to get grafts put in, like to have a what they call a CABG or a bypass graft. And when that happens, you got to go back on the heparin after heart cath.
Oh, shit.
So she comes back after her cath shows multivessel disease and she's put back on a heparin drip after the procedure. Immediately, 30 minutes later, she's cold, she's clammy, she's confused, she's doing all of the things, her blood sugar becomes unstable in the exact same boat. Exact same boat.
Why didn't they, I'm sorry.
Here's the thing, to us on paper, this makes perfect sense, and we're following it going, oh, well, why didn't they do this? But
I know, it's hard. In the moment.
In the moment.
We have this whole big picture because we know what happens and whatnot, but I'm just... And I know we have certain procedures now
mm-hmm.
because of things like that.
Yes.
So I have to remind myself that it's 30 years later
mm-hmm.
that we have certain procedures when there's fuck shits like that that happen.
It's all the fuck shits.
But I'm just like,
mm-hmm.
did anybody check?
I know. I know. Like I said.
So this girl, it not happened to her once, but it happened to her twice.
Yep. Obviously, something's going on with the heparin here. After already
finding insulin in a heparin bag.
Yes.
Mm.
Devin's feeling some type of way.
I'm just
getting some vibes.
I get angry.
She does get angry. It's a whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, down the hall, a patient named Fred Belf was in the exact same boat. And he was on heparin, started on heparin, became acutely hypoglycemic, and was all of a sudden real hard to keep alive.
Real hard.
So staff are like, I'm going to go ahead and let these connections start to make themselves here because what the fuck is going on? Like now, every heparin bag we're hanging, somebody's getting hypoglycemic. Like what is going on? What is actually going on? And immediately, Fred's unhooked from his heparin. Like they take him off the heparin. They're like, we don't know what's going on. And of course, they have this tampered with bag down in the pharmacy that they're testing. And his Fred Belf's bag of heparin, the unfinished bag and the tubing was sent down to the pathology lab for testing positive for insulin, mm-hmm. massive amounts.
Mm-hmm.
A microanalysis of the bag found a series of tiny holes in that rubber stopper in the bottom. So again, tamper evident, right?
Mm-hmm.
This raised obvious concern that somebody on the unit is poisoning bags of heparin in the storage room at St. Barnabas with massive amounts of insulin. They dug back and they realize there may be a connection as codes had become so frequent and so much that they often overlapped. And there were multiple cases of unexplained hypoglycemia. They were like, wait a minute. Look how many hypoglycemic events we've had recently. It just happened
to this girl twice.
It just happened to this girl twice. But also, like, I'm now remembering, like, a couple weeks ago, we had, like, three on the floor on one mm-hmm. shift. Like, what? Like, maybe it's been the heparin this whole time. By the way, both of those patients survived.
Thank goodness.
Their ordeals, thankfully. It was very close. Now, at first, they were like, are these nursing med errors? Are these people getting bolus?
Too much insulin?
Like, there's got to be, we've got to make sure there's not a possibility that that's not the problem here.
Right.
So many of these patients, though, that were getting hypoglycemic events aren't even diabetic. And it would be very unlikely, you know, med errors do happen. You know, sometimes people get the wrong dose of insulin, but it would be unusual for somebody who's the entirely wrong patient to also get the entirely wrong med, right? Mm-hmm. So that'd be like a double error. That's hard to do, especially with something as high alert as insulin, which mm-hmm. like, I don't know if they had as strict high alert protocols as they did back in, you know, back in the day as they do now, where right. like now we have to double sign certain things and have people witness us do things. But that would be a little bit interesting. Massive investigation gets launched internally, and they investigated patient visitors and every single shift that worked, and LNAs and not even just nurses, like literally anybody in and out of the unit they were investigating. Once it was ruled out that, you know, some external person was coming in and doing this to the nursing stuff, which like is pretty far-fetched. I mean, you got to kind of know a way around the unit to get a syringe. I know.
Empty your pockets.
Exactly. You got to kind of know your way around the unit to like go get a syringe, go get a vial of insulin, go, you know, you got to have access to all that shit. Leading the investigation was Joe Barry. He was the St. Barnabas Medical Center vice president and a 30-year police veteran. In a previous life. So he actually was like uniquely qualified for this particular situation. There was a massive internal review of the staff and the scheduling, trying to identify who on staff is on during the majority of these events. Because obviously, the problem is if these bags are being spiked and then left in storage. Mm-hmm. Can you really create a pattern out of that?
Mm-hmm.
Because these bags could maybe sit in the storage closet for days full of insulin until they finally get picked and hung. And then it's like that goes out the window, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard to say exactly, you know, what they were able to find. They were able to create a little bit of a pattern, though. And then Joe Barry was able to find that only three nurses were working every single event. And Charlie Cullen was one of them. He was one of the three nurses that were working every single event that happened. So
this comes into the hypothesis. What did they call it with Kristen Gilbert? The hypothesis to statistics.
Creating all the
probability that this is just a coincidence.
You know that meme with like Julia Roberts like furrowing her brow and there's like all this like math like just like superimposed over her. It's like that little picture. That's what I get. That's the visual that I get. And then Barry notes that while he was starting to interview the staff members in question, everybody was like upset, nervous, you know, scared that their jobs were on the line, or like, you know, obviously upset that somebody was thinking that maybe they had something to do with this, because I know that I, as a floor nurse, if somebody is suspecting that I might have done something intentionally to harm one of my patients, I would be an absolute puddle of beside myself. Mm-hmm. I would like not be okay, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is to be expected. And of course, you know, they would be upset to, even if it wasn't intentionally, like no nurse that is there with good intentions wants to cause harm to anybody in any way.
Mm-hmm.
But not Cullen. It was immediately apparent that he was like not nervous at all. He was actually, you know, super cooperative, super cool, calm and collected. He genuinely actually seemed like apathetic to the entire situation, which that was like suspicious. Like he really just seemed like he was kind of like couldn't really be bothered to offer any help with this.
Why
bullshit.
Do I need to be here?
Why am I here? And actually, on a subsequent interview, Joe had said that he had sort of crossed his arms and was like kind of leaning back and like refusing to answer questions. And it's like, if you're going to give like that demeanor, that's like that's
you're
suspicious right there.
Man.
Like, that's not really cooperative. And at this point, the investigators were like starting to get a little suspicious just based on his demeanor that like he's not telling us everything.
Mm-hmm.
So finally, one of the investigators tells him point blank, I know you put something in those IV bags, Charlie. And Charlie's response was, quote, you can't prove anything.
I was going to say, I remember mm-hmm. this. It was pretty ballsy.
Yep. So they alert police right away because they were like, so that's something. I don't
mm-hmm.
know what that is, but that's a something.
Mm-hmm.
Police Chief Don Jones of the Livingston PD was the lead investigator. And Joe Barry had collected a bunch of evidence on Cullen and had worked super hard developing all these timelines, which all pointed towards Charlie. And they try to catch him in the act. They failed. There were cameras on the unit that they had equipped and they had tried monitoring, but they were never able to catch him in the act doing mm-hmm. anything on camera. Unfortunately, all of the evidence that was gathered against him was circumstantial because they did not have any witnesses and they did not have any hard evidence. Nothing could be proven. So in late 1991, Charlie Cullen was fired, but from St. Barnabas, and the problems with insulin-tainted heparin bags mysteriously vanished.
Shocker.
Shocker. And I think this is a good place to stop.
You can't prove anything.
You can't prove anything.
Ballsy.
I mean, wow.
We can't yet, but
we
someone
will someday be able to prove something about
someone
you.
Someone will.
Mister.
It's interesting. I really like doing this over again because there's certain things that I forget.
I know. No, me too.
You understand the basis of like, oh yeah, I know who he is. But then it's like when you get into the details of like how like bastardly
the scale and how fucking ballsy
mm-hmm.
and like he knew what he was doing. I know there were obvious mental health issues there were obvious substance abuse issues there, but like he made a conscious decision every single time he fucking picked up a syringe,
which is why I'm having a hard time believing that he wasn't doing the suicide attempts for attention.
Oh, I agree. I think a lot of it was...
You figured out how to kill other people.
Yes.
You can figure out how to do yourself.
Yes. That's pretty true. That's pretty true.
Well, thank you for listening, everyone.
Yep.
If you want to keep following along, you can search for us on Facebook at Med Crimes Podcast.
You can search for us on YouTube at Med Crimes Podcast.
You can follow us on Instagram at Med Crimes Podcast.
If you wish to become a Patreon, you can find us at www.patreon.com/medcrimespodcast. And it's super fun there. We'd love to have you.
Woo-hoo! You can send us any of your crazy stories, ideas, any feedback that you want to send. We enjoy hearing from you at medcrimes@gmail.com.
Stay safe out there from the safety hedge.
Dun, dun, dun.